This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
So welcome to Psych Tech, the psychology and technology podcast. My name is Josue Cardona, and if it sounds a little noisy and you guess that this is another outside on the road episode with Ali Mattu about Star Trek, you are correct. You are correct.
It's a pretty strong correlation now between me being on Psych Tech and us being outside.
Yes, yes.
I think it's a... Two data points, 100% match up, so there you go.
All right, nerd, before we keep going,
yeah.
Give me a second. To inform people about why Kelly is in here, okay? Kelly had a baby.
What?
Yeah, and we have...
Congratulations, Kelly.
We have the best maternity leave policy in the business, okay? So she's out, and when she feels like coming back, she will come back.
Wait, am I the maternity leave policy that when you are taking maternity leave, Ali Mattu has to appear?
In Kelly's contract, it says she will be substituted by random people.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You are random people.
I'm a random person.
Yep.
Okay, sounds good.
And this is, we're actually just picking up exactly where we left off last time when the diner closed on us at midnight.
So last time we were talking about psychology and technology on the heels of seeing Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah.
And we got cut off right as we started to talk about replicators a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Josue, last time we watched Star Trek Beyond, today we did something pretty cool too that I think will inform our discussion.
Yeah. So technically, can we see it from here, from where we are?
We can see it a little
sort
bit.
Sort of, right?
Yeah.
So... We are very close to the Intrepid Air and Space Museum in New York City, where they currently have the Star Trek Starfleet Academy experience.
That's right.
Where we signed up, we went through all these tests.
Yeah.
We went through this. We took pictures on a bridge.
Yep.
It was fantastic. We got like these communicators. We were enlisted. I ended up being accepted into their communications program.
Both of us did.
Yep. Or a backup is engineering.
Yeah, my backup's command, so I'm pretty excited about that.
That's good. That's
also good. Excited that as a communications officer, I get to work with Uhura and Hoshi Sato, so that's pretty cool. They're very skilled in linguistics.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's perfect.
For me, like working
anyway.
With people.
Yeah, communications and engineering sounds about right.
And I like bossing people around.
Yeah, yeah, you do. Yeah. They know what they're doing there. That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. And actually, before today, like we just came out of that, had lunch, and now we're recording. But before that, I did see, I want to make sure I remember his name. I went to a presentation at the Intrepid, actually, a few weeks ago, by Gene Dolgoff. And he is considered the father of holography. So there is actually a science of holograms, right? And he kind of created that stuff. And he talked to Gene Roddenberry and convinced him that holodeck is possible. So it was a lot about the technology in Star Trek, that talk that I saw. And I don't know, that's going to inform kind of my conversation today, too. So we've had a couple experiences.
Should we start there? Should we start?
Yeah.
Because we didn't talk about holodecks last time.
We did not. And, yeah, I mean, what are your notes on holography?
Well, so since last time, too, I attended the American Psychological Association convention in Denver. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
It was a lot of fun. It was good. It was good. It was a week, but it was good. And I got to attend a panel by Dr. Kelly Slack. She's a NASA psychologist. And one of the things that she talked about is how NASA psychologists are very much involved in the health, sleep, and teamwork criteria that goes into selecting astronauts, but then also maintaining the health, the sleep, and the teamwork of astronauts during orbits. And one of the things that she said was really interesting to me is not only do they use VR in training astronauts, But they think VR, essentially our version of the holodeck, is going to be the technology that's going to help astronauts on Mars. And the reason is, right now, the number one leisure activity of astronauts in orbit on the International Space Station is looking at planet Earth. That is their number one set source of leisure, of connection. It's a thing that they love to do together. About a day 125 into the Mars mission, you're no longer going to be able to see Earth. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you're going to be seeing the same thing over and over again on the mission to Mars and once you've landed on Mars. So the holodeck, which makes a ton of sense in Star Trek as a leisure activity, is probably going to be how we're going to help our astronauts maintain their mental health when they're on long-term missions, especially when we go to Mars.
Again, so VR specifically, right?
VR,
now.
Yeah.
And it's good enough right now where they can, where they're using it. Like it's a thing. Yeah.
So there was a big, as we're recording this, it's a day after, there was a big mission, a spacewalk to install a new connection for private space vehicles to be able to dock to the International Space Station. A lot of the work, the preparation for that was done through VR, practicing every single step of that mission. It's good enough for that. And they're also talking about installing virtual windows on the mission to Mars that will provide a little bit of a connection. It'll probably look, better than the Back to the Future 2 version of those windows. But this type of technology is going to be a pretty big deal for space and for here.
Yeah, I mean, you could simulate, like if it was a train ride, for example, right? Or you could simulate some other landscape or anything, I'm guessing, right?
Absolutely.
Is that kind of what they're looking at?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can take things with it. Like, I imagine that you could have a VR program designed to your hometown.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an astronaut going out there. And these are all just, like, space science implications of VR and holodeck technology, but there's a lot of terrestrial you and me applications. I know you're a big proponent of VR,
and you've kind of
talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, on the show, we've talked about it a few times. This is the year where people can go out and buy a consumer version of VR. There's different options. And actually, the HTC Vive is available for purchase, and it has this... it's like instead of changing your desktop background, right, you can change where you kind of set up your VR experiences, and it has a holodeck option. So it looks like the TNG, black with the orange lines, you know? So it looks just like that when it's off, right? It looks exactly like that. And I think that's one of the coolest things where there's that obvious connection of being transported to a different place by having all of your senses be tricked, essentially.
Well, so that's the thing, right? With holodeck technology, it's projected photons, and it creates all of those senses. You have a sense of smell. There's a tactile feedback, of course, audio and visual and all of that. But you feel yourself in that space. Now, until we get better haptic feedback, similar to Ready Player One, where they wear these haptic suits, VR is still right now stuck with visual and auditory feedback, and that's pretty good. But once we do get the haptic feedback, once we get more of that smell aspect, one of my favorite rides at Disney is Soarin', and they just redid it, and I haven't been on the new version yet. But one of the things I love about Soarin', it's like you're hand gliding over California. And you go over these, like, orange groves. And as you go over, there's this smell of citrus. And it's kind of enough for you to feel in that moment like you're there. So if we can get enough of the senses into VR, I think it's going to be good enough to be a replacement for the holodeck. A replacement, again, I'm saying as if the holodeck exists right now. But, you know, Josue, you showed me the Star Trek video game that's coming out that's actually a VR experience on the bridge.
Yeah.
So, like, the circles, or the dots are beginning to connect a little bit here with the holodeck.
Yeah, and something like that is really, it's not hard to feel immersed because you're sitting in a chair, right?
Yeah.
Every person is assigned a role, and if you're sitting in a chair, whether it's on a space shuttle or at home and you have your VR on, now in the game you're sitting down. So it's different if it's something like soaring or running or moving from one place to another. There are experiences like that, but they don't have to be, you know, you can approximate the experience to the actual physical location and setting and, you know, where you are, and it helps. Like, most of the VR experiences I plan on having for the rest of the year with the equipment that I'm getting is sitting down. So, like, being in a cockpit,
yeah,
right? So
yeah.
I'll be doing X-Wing fighter pilot kind of stuff. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I'm looking forward to. I'm actually not looking forward to moving around in a room and playing with a whole bunch of things. I want to be, like, have that feeling of sitting in a cockpit and flying an X-Wing. Or being out in space. Or flying a plane or something like that, you know? And then that's a lot easier if you're already sitting down.
And those are experiences that are not quite in your... things that you can't easily access. And for me, one of the big implications of this technology is in exposure-based treatments.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really... So the most effective way to treat anxiety disorders is slowly help people to get exposed to them. So it's a similar principle to jumping in the ocean. Or a pool, when you jump into it, it feels cold, but your body gets used to it. That's a process called habituation. You just get used to stuff that remains the same. We use that to treat anxiety disorders, where we slowly habituate you to the feared stimulus, whether it's spiders, whether it's social anxiety, whether it's a feeling of panic that you might be having a heart attack, or whatever it might be. But there's certain things that are harder for me to do. Since 9/11 happened here in the United States, it's been much more difficult to do airplane and airport-based, exposure-based treatment. You have to have a plane ticket to go beyond security. What you used to be able to do before is to do a lot of the airport-level exposure. You didn't even need an airplane ticket. Back in the olden days, you could walk all the way to the gate. You didn't even need a ticket. VR can allow us to do that type of treatment, and it's not a replacement for what we call in vivo in the environment, but it is a wonderful way to do to prepare someone for that. Similarly, some natural environment anxiety, like thunderstorms, thunder and lightning, it's very hard to do thunder and lightning exposure because the real environment, it's so rare to predict when you're going to get thunder and lightning. But VR could really pinpoint that and get you a ton of exposure based on it. And VR exposure treatments have been around before, but they kind of sucked. They don't really look that great.
Like, the military has been using these for probably
for PTSD
two decades.
And training, yeah. It's been using it for a long time.
Yeah. And instead of taking you in theater, right, you go and you do it here, you know, at a base. You do it at home, and it can approximate that feeling and slowly bring you back. And so we have a lot of data to back up that this works, you know? We have years of it.
And speaking of healthcare-related implications, we've got the emergency medical hologram, right? The EMH on Star Trek Voyager.
Yep.
And I think this is where stuff starts to get even more interesting. So one of the big areas in not just in psychology, but in many forms of healthcare right now is telehealth. How do we extend the reach of quality healthcare to rural populations or to disaster areas?
Yep.
So what I envision is we're probably going to get things like the EMH, where we combine holographic projection, we combine
AI,
artificial intelligence, augmented reality as well. Like, imagine this. Imagine that there's been some type of natural disaster, but you have some type of visor situation, not like Geordi LaForge visor, but I'm thinking more like Deep Space Nine, Dominion War, Commander Sisko wearing this like visor, which is like a kind of a Google Glass type thing. But you as an untrained individual could provide emergency first aid to other people by having it projected on your visor, what to do, what the diagnosis is, what's the best way to do some triaging and help people who are in crisis. The implications here for extending care to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to get it are almost there. You combine drone technology, which you don't really see in Star Trek, too. Our ability to be able to get into remote areas and provide intervention or safety is pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. I think going back to the holographics part, right? I mean, the idea of projecting something that looks more real. Again, the Doctor on Voyager is a hologram, but he's also an AI. So even though we have AI right now, it's like, when is IBM going to give Watson a physical form?
Yeah.
You know? What is he going to look like? You know?
I think people are kind of scared to do that.
Maybe, right? And actually, so Watson is applied to different areas, so they'll give him different names depending on the company who's kind of using the technology and for different purposes. But then you just, you know, you give it a voice and you give it a physical appearance, and now there's a lot more. I think it goes into affective computing, right? Now, mm-hmm. the idea that that computer cares about you, right, or is interested in what you have to say, is actually listening to you. It's very, very different when there's a face looking back at you, right? To there just being a voice. And then the more lifelike that it is, the more natural the experience, right?
Yeah. I think the affective computing part is a good point. I'm not a big fan of Siri, but one of the things that I do like about Siri is some of Siri's responses feel a little bit more like there's a personality behind Siri. Mm-hmm. That is pretty cool. It feels like there's a little bit more affect, a little bit more emotion built into it. And Siri's not artificial intelligence. Siri's all kind of like a flow chart program of if you say this, Siri responds with that. But
it's a virtual assistant / getting closer to, I mean, I would call it an AI, but it's not, you know, we're far from the Doctor.
We're far from the Doctor. And yeah. There's Cortana, and I forget what Google's version is.
Alexa. Oh, no. Google is just Google Now, and then Alexa for Amazon.
Yep. Yeah. So sorry if we've activated all of your devices.
Well, you know, actually, I had a funny interaction with Siri the other day. I was on my way to go see the movie Suicide Squad.
Yep.
And just the mention of the word suicide triggered Siri to ask me if everything was okay and if I wanted her to call the suicide hotline for me. Now, it was interesting because the way it did it was super jarring and it shocked me. Because I was walking, I just used my earbuds and I said, I think my question was, where's the nearest theater playing Suicide Squad? And then it just stopped and said, are you okay? Or something. I forgot exactly what it said, but it was kind of jarring. So it could work on, you know, that delivery in a way that maybe didn't, like, put me off, you know? It was kind of more real.
And that points to a very cool thing that's happening. The suicide-based interventions that are happening on Facebook in particular are fantastic. Where we're getting a little bit better at picking up on content that might be correlated with being suicidal. I mean, Matt Nock is a psychologist at Harvard, and he's trying to, him and his lab are trying to understand what are the subtle cues that are associated and are predictive of becoming suicidal. And how can we better detect those cues? Now, if you take his research and combine it with something like Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or Instagram, and we're able to pinpoint people who are vulnerable and connect them with resources, that's fantastic. But as you demonstrated, the problem is our tools are so broad right now, and they aren't very good at pinpointing subtlety, like differentiating Suicide Squad versus feeling suicidal.
Or presenting me the option with subtlety.
Yeah.
You know? It's like if suddenly your screen starts flashing red or your Instagram feed starts flashing red, it's like, do you need help? Like, it's very different than, hey, you know, how you feeling? How you doing? Yeah. I'm picking up on a little something.
Something's
you know?
Up. Yeah. So since we're talking so much about healthcare here, there's another topic, and I kind of alluded to this at the end of part one, and I wanted to talk about this, but Star Trek's technology, or as we learned at the exhibit, Treknology.
That's going to be the name of this episode.
That was actually written a few different times, which is awesome. Yep. But one of the things that Star Trek has done is it's vastly extended life. So We see this in the first episode of The Next Generation, where DeForest Kelly reprises his role as Bones, as Dr. Leonard McCoy, and he meets Data. And you see him as an aged man, very much aged. He's over 100 years old. And I think he's like 130 or something like that. But what we see in Star Trek over and over again is the lifespan of humanity has really reached kind of its upper limits. If you die of old age, you're in your like 130s, 140s, or something like that. Now, Vulcans, they live a lot longer, so you see a lot of old Vulcans. That's why so Spock is around in pretty much every iteration of Star Trek. But there's pretty big implications to that, Josue, and we're starting to see some of those implications now with baby boomers. So what we're starting to see is lifespan in the developed world is very much expanding.
Across the board, every country, right?
Every
all
country,
around the world, yep.
Every country, most pronounced in developed nations. But what we're seeing is we're seeing new lifespans, or new phases of life, I should say. So we're seeing this at both the young end as well as the older end. So now 30 is the new 20. So there's this whole new...
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, there's good research on this called about the topic of emerging adulthood, where people spend their 20s as a period of exploration, of kind of figuring themselves out. They try out new things. It's much more culturally common to move back in with your parents for periods in your 20s. And part of this is like maps along with our knowledge of the brain, that the brain, especially the frontal lobe, continues to develop into your early 20s. But we see this with emerging adulthood. We're also seeing this with older individuals as well, where you you now go through several periods where you have emerging adulthood, you have your first phase of adulthood, and maybe your first career. And then maybe you start a family, but then your kids move out eventually, and you're in another phase. And now, as life expands have been extended, people enter a third phase. It's not necessarily going straight into retirement. And we see this in Star Trek as well. We saw this with Captain Picard in All Good Things, the last episode of The Next Generation. We see that he spends more of his twilight years in his family's vineyard. And people do many different things once your life has expanded. So that's a huge difference. You know, it wasn't that long ago that you and I would be reaching the end phase of our life, where people would 30s and 40s are pushing it. But that's not the case anymore, and that has huge implications for society. It has huge implications for what your opportunities are in your life.
I just had a couple kidney stones, right?
Yeah.
It took almost 3 months to get a diagnosis and a visit to the ER and a whole bunch of... Actually, I've brought it up on the show before. And the beauty of the tricorder, right, which is... It's just faster diagnosis, right? So the faster we can diagnose things, the faster we can find things out, the faster we can treat them, the faster we can be okay and live longer, right? I think that's the secret, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in general, we'll get better at medicine, right? But I think that diagnosing period, the faster we can diagnose and treat, the better. And right now, it still sucks. It is horrible, you know? And it can be invasive, and it can be extremely expensive. Like, I needed to get a CAT scan after multiple tests before somebody said, oh, yeah, this is the thing that you have.
So that's actually the key to, if you look at cancer treatment, it is far more effective to diagnose earlier and get better at identifying cancer early on than it is treating cancer later, once it's at later stages. So if you have limited resources, you really want to invest on early diagnosis. And that's the problem with things like pancreatic cancer, it's incredibly hard to diagnose. So the tricorder is very cool because it's a highly portable, highly portable way of scanning the environment and scanning life forms. What Star Trek misses out on is personalized medicine. And so right now there is an XPRIZE out. We had an XPRIZE for first commercial spaceflight, and now there's an XPRIZE out to create a tricorder. It's actually called like the XPRIZE for tricorders. And what I think if we combine that with smartphones, which, you know, your smartphone and your tablet is already more powerful than most Star Trek technology, especially the pad. But if we are able to combine a more sophisticated sensor with something like a smartphone that has so much data on you, we can actually program it to pick up on subtle cues before they become larger problems. So to pick up on your health patterns and health behavior to say, hey, Jose, it sounds like you're slowing down a bit. Maybe those are early signs of depression. Or it can pick up on your acuity with your fingers and say that, you know, these might be actually early signs of some type of neurological-based problem. We can pick up on early signs of dementia. We can pick up on a lot of this stuff, and you don't have to go to the hospital for that. It's already with the device that you hold. And NASA is actually looking at some of this stuff as well. One of the problems with being in a space station or being on a long mission is you're trapped with the team that you have. And now, what if you have a conflict with one of your teammates? NASA is working on developing proximity scanners that will be able to figure out if your someone on your team is isolating themselves, or if someone on your team is struggling in some way, and mission control can then intervene in a way in which, and they already have like weekly one-to-one sessions with their behavioral specialists, so they're like their therapy sessions. So if NASA can pick up earlier that there's something going on, someone's isolating themselves, they can intervene earlier before it threatens the mission. That kind of stuff is really awesome. And that kind of stuff goes away. We're not that far away from having more personal and based earlier intervention stuff.
Well, right now, for example, as working with clients, right, there's only so much behavioral data that we can possibly process as human beings, right? So even with wearables and the Internet of Things full of sensors, there's a lot of stuff, and the more... Again, we say this term on the show all the time, the more meaningful that data, then we can actually act upon it and do something with it, right? So if that data is being collected all the time and the data sorting and management is good enough that it can figure something out with that, then you can bring it to a behavior specialist that can actually give some recommendations and do something about it. But right now, like, we can't read all that information, right? Even if I were watching two people who were going to be on a space station together for a year, I can't watch them 24/7. I can't see every interaction. It's not the same. You know, there's only so much that a person can do.
Yeah.
But all of that data can be collected and can be qualified.
Well, and that's one of the things that is a problem right now is we have, you know, the internet of all these different things, and we haven't quite yet figured out a way to integrate that data to be able to communicate, coordinate that data. I have a Nest at home, but my Nest has a great app, and it controls a thermostat. It doesn't really connect with much else in my home right now. So there isn't really a good solution for that. And in Star Trek, you've got LCARS, the Library Computer and Retrieval System, I think is what that stands for. That's an operating system that runs pretty much everything there. But again, as we mentioned in the last episode, pretty much everyone in Starfleet only uses LCARS, and the Cardassians only use their system, and Klingons only use their system. We don't see a lot of diversity of platforms, which is how things work right now. But one cool thing about LCARS is each station, whenever you use the interface, it is customized to the tasks that you have at hand. So if you actually read the Star Trek Next Generation Technical Manual, as I have, cover to cover.
Of course.
Of course. They talked about having task-specific, touch-based interfaces that can change and be customized to whatever you're doing way back before we had the touchscreen interfaces that all of us now have on our smartphones, which is really cool. I think that's completely come to fruition. Whether you use iOS or Android or Windows, they all are basically functioning in a similar way as LCARS does, and I love that idea.
Yeah. What else do you have in your notes that we haven't covered?
I've got one big thing that I wanted to talk about, and that's the Kobayashi Maru.
Oh.
So the Kobayashi Maru is this test. It's a assessment of your ability to command. It's a no-win scenario. We're introduced to it in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and then we actually see it happen in the 2009 Star Trek film. There's an updated version of it in Star Trek The Next Generation that Will Wheaton's Wesley Crusher goes through. And what I love about this is, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion about testing. And what I love about the Kobayashi Maru is it's a behavioral test. And it's you're in the actual scenario and you have to actually participate, and it was, yeah, it's a no-win scenario, but you actually are in the exact type of situation. And that type of testing, that type of sort of what we call in healthcare competency-based testing is a pretty good way to measure if someone's actually able to do what we want them to be able to do. A lot of the testing that we have in this country when it comes to education is knowledge-based testing. And knowing one thing through a knowledge-based test, like, you know, most of the tests you take in school, is a bit different than a behavioral test that's looking on, can you actually do the thing that you're supposed to be able to do?
Like, so a driving exam, the written versus like the practical.
Exactly. That's a great example. That's a great example. And acing your written tests for your driver's license is very different than acing the driving test. So that's an example of a technology, if you want to call it that, that we still have, or that's in Star Trek and that we actually have right now, and that I think we should actually move towards more. Like, as we get more VR, we can do more simulation-based tests that are going to be a better predictor of, can you actually do the thing that we want you to be able to do?
It's funny, we just did the Kobayashi Maru as part of the...
Yeah.
We just took the test as part of the Starfleet Academy
How many
experience.
People did you save?
160.
I saved 10.
We still both died. They all died in the end.
It's no win.
Yeah,
it rated me as high on aggression. Because I tried to kill one of the Klingon ships. There's three Klingon ships that appear. And I tried to get rid of one to increase the chances that I'd be there longer. But that didn't help me save a lot of people.
So one thing that's interesting about being in that bridge, right, and seeing all those screens, is that even if in the movie, right, when you look at 2009, the reboot movie, and when they take the Kobayashi Maru, it looks like it could have been playing out like an actual scene from the movie. Because they're in the bridge, they're seeing things through the viewfinder, or the view screen, right, through the view screen, and it's a very good simulation. And now bear with me here. This world that we see in Star Trek, everything happens on these flat screens. And technically, I mean, you mentioned drones before. There's no reason for the fleet for the crew to actually be there. They could be doing all of that remotely because they're just hitting buttons and looking at something on a screen.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Dean, the holography guy, was saying in his presentation was that it was really interesting how in Star Trek, everything seems flat and 2D.
Yeah.
When in Star Wars, everything is presented in 3D, including Leia's first message, right?
Sure.
It's a hologram, right, that's projected. With the exception of the Doctor and Voyager, you know, everything is presented kind of in these 2D screens. And I'm starting to draw this parallel between us now constantly doing everything on a computer screen or on our phone, just tapping on a screen, and how that's not real, right? And we have that discussion all the time. And like, that's what Star Trek is, you know, when they're on the ship. Now, when they beam down and they're on the planet and there's all these interactions that happens. But there's that approximation, right, of having just stuff on screens happening is eerily happening, you know?
So this is a great point, because if you look at the original series, it is more tactile. There's buttons. There's things to move and things and all of that.
Knobs
all of that.
And lights.
Knobs. Yeah, yeah. And in
switches.
When we get to the Next Generation, and even in Star Trek movies, most of the with the original cast, most of those movies have more buttons and knobs and levers and things like that. But once we get to the Next Generation, it is that sterile screen, task dependent interface. Now, what's cool about 2009 Star Trek, and now we know the official term is the Kelvin universe, what we used to call the JJ-verse or the parallel universe. With that version, you see a little bit more of a mixture of the two worlds. So you're kind of speaking to how this vision with the Next Generation, we're seeing more of that play out now. Yeah. More touch-based interfaces, less buttons and knobs, and more surfaces.
Yeah, so like our phones and our tablets are slates. Our computers are slates, right? And then how many times are you using something that's not even a physical keyboard anymore, right?
But you also mentioned something which I want to spend a bit of time talking to you about, and that is everything that's being done on the Enterprise could probably be done from a drone. And this reminds me of an article that my friend Ryan Britt wrote. And Ryan Britt is going to be on the panel that you and I are doing.
Actually, plug that right now.
Yeah, let's do it. So in just 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, here in New York City.
On September 2nd.
On September 2nd at 5:30, Josue, you and I and a few of our friends are going to be doing a panel on the evolution of Star Trek fandom.
Yes.
It's going to be awesome.
Yes.
It's going to be a celebration of Star Trek fandom and exploration of the good, bad, and ugly side of the fandom. And it's going to be done at this awesome convention that's also a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. So we're going to celebrate the 50 years of fandom. But one of the things that Ryan Britt wrote about in this great article is how ridiculous it is that Star Trek is still based on this 60s vision of the future. And we saw a little bit of that at this experience that you and I went to.
We saw a lot of it.
We saw a lot of it. So the Star Trek communicator and universal translator looks and feels so dated now based on smartphones.
Yeah.
The pad seems so dated now based on the iPad. Drone technology is not anywhere in Star Trek, really. They do launch probes, but those probes are never remotely controlled.
If they need to fix something outside the hull, they actually walk outside.
They actually walk outside instead of like launching Enterprise drone or something like that. The singularity is never really explored in Star Trek. Again, is the computer conscious? I don't know. It created Moriarty for a holographic adventure with Data, and he was kind of sentient. But this stuff isn't really explored. And we now know the name of the new Star Trek television show. It's going to be called Star Trek Discovery. It's coming out in January. We also know that it takes place about 10 years before Kirk. So it's going to be in this place. Well, 10 years before Kirk takes command. So we know it's going to be like a sequel to Star Trek Enterprise, but a prequel to the original series, and it's going to take place in the Prime universe. But is Star Trek really doing a disservice as it relates to technology by being stuck in this original vision of how all this stuff works instead of going in a new direction and being true to the idea of speculative fiction and projecting forward based on where we are right now, kind of like Black Mirror does?
Yeah, that's something that for me is pretty disappointing, because they could move further in time and then show us more of that bright future, right? Based on the technology that we have now, they could speculate further in the future. Man, I do feel like they're going to purposefully write themselves into a corner, because they already have all of these things established in the Prime universe that they have to follow. They can't go faster than the warp that's been established in the original series. They can't do so many things that we even see in the Next Generation, which were advances to the original series. We can't see any of that, right? And so in terms of the futurism aspect, it is disappointing just for that, you know, for that aspect. I am curious, though, how close is that? Like the whole question that we brought up at the beginning, or that I brought up to you at the beginning of that last episode that we did, was that utopia, right? Like Star Trek has this very bright future, and right now we has this very bright future. And how do you you know, how much of that, is it already established by the time that Discovery is going to be around? Like, would, do you think we'll see some of that playing out? Maybe the effect of this new technology, right, that we already accept as real in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager?
I mean, there are certain things they can't really do. Like, they can't have androids running around. They can't have replicator and holographic technology. They are stuck in certain ways. And now, Nicholas Meyer, the director of Star Trek II, and the person who really rebooted Star Trek for the movies after the motion picture and the weird existential pajama pant exploration that was Star Trek the motion picture, he's like, we need to turn this into something else, like, and rebooted the movie franchise as this like naval sort of voyage and submarine kind of voyage. He's involved in Star Trek Discovery, as is Brian Fuller,
yeah,
who has great credentials both inside and outside Star Trek. So I've got faith, and all of them have said this is going to be a new exploration. Brian Fuller has said the lead character is going to be a lieutenant commander female. It's not the captain. This is the first time the lead in the show is not going to be the captain. So that's going to be a different view. And if you see that ship, which I think kind of looks not that great, but it's
very sharp.
Yeah, it's very pointy. It looks much more like the some of the original concept art from the 70s for a different version of the Star Trek or Starfleet.
The sequel to like the original series, the follow-up.
Yeah, the follow-up that was abandoned. It looks a lot more like that, but it also looks like a little bit of blend of Klingon technology with Federation technology. So maybe Discovery is some type of covert ops ship, and it is some type of hybrid with the Klingons. So we might see some different technology that never played out later on because it was so covert, it was so experimental.
Well, now that part does excite me because there's this cultural aspect to it, right? Like this social aspect to it. Like, how are these races interacting now that they're possibly forced to work together,
yeah,
or something like that? You know, something that, again, it's touched upon in every single series, but to focus mostly on that.
And
will,
yeah,
be,
I mean Voyager had the opportunity to focus more on that with the Maquis and the Federation crews, but it never quite did that. Everyone sort of, again, was able to use all the technology seamlessly. You know, I have trouble using the newest version of Windows because I use Mac at home, and I'm not familiar with it. But here in the 24th century, everyone can use Cardassian devices and Klingon devices and Romulan devices and Federation devices. That just doesn't make much sense. So I hope with Discovery we'll get more of that speculative fiction, of that exploration of where we are now and projecting that forward. I hope they do take some departures, even if it does break with canon a little bit. Star Trek Enterprise...
No, you can't do that.
But they have to. I mean, that was the problem with Enterprise, right? They created this temporal Cold War as a way of deviating from the plot, but that wasn't what got me excited about Enterprise. What got me excited about Enterprise were all the episodes that were about the founding of the Federation. And they were able to introduce some kind of interesting technology, like the way they use universal translators. It didn't quite always work. The transporter wasn't as reliable. And the problem with breaking with canon, and the problem that Enterprise ran into, is when you establish rules in the universe, people will get behind it. But once you start breaking the rules or messing with them, then things don't make sense. Like in Enterprise, it's established that the transporter is not that advanced, and you can't be like running and be transported. But then in a later episode, a couple seasons later, Commander Archer or Captain Archer is like falling and they transport him, and you're like, wait, I thought like you don't have as advanced stuff. So with Discovery, please explore some new ideas, new technology, go into some new areas, and then kind of be consistent with how it's laid out. I'm okay if they depart with some of the canon if we get some interesting storylines and some interesting ideas behind it.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't had a series in 10 years, so whatever we get, I'm excited. Hope it's good.
I hope it's good.
In the States, you can watch it on CBS All Access. Outside of the States, it'll be on Netflix.
Everywhere else, it'll be on Netflix.
I know,
yeah,
I know, I know.
Yeah, I wish it was on Netflix here, but there you go. I mean, that's the big technology stuff that I've got. I think we covered a lot of it. 3D printers we didn't talk about. I think 3D printers are our version of replicators, what we have right now.
Yeah, it's the closest thing we have right now. And, I mean, there's a lot of... See, like, I don't know how much... I mean, and we've deviated, again, away from that original question of like, how does it help to create a utopia? But definitely having a replicator, it's like, well, I don't have to cook. You know, I don't have to do that now. I can... Right now, there are food printers. They're not great, right? If you really want to do that, you can do that. But the truth is that you can make stuff at home if you have the money.
Yeah.
You can just have the machine and make it at home as long as you have the design. And simpler things, like maybe, you know, I need to replace this knob on this device that I have in front of me.
Yeah.
I could print that out, you know, if I have the design. That isn't at a level right now where it's so cheap. You know, actually, I wonder... In Star Trek, I mean, the starships have them. But, like, do people have replicators at home? You know? Is that also, like,
it depends. There's people who do and people who don't. So, like, Benjamin Sisko's dad, he's a chef. He runs a restaurant. He hates replicators. So I don't think he has one at home.
Yeah.
And I think he barely uses one. And what's interesting here is one of the ways in which things might change is... The value we associate with replicated items versus handmade probably would change.
So right, this idea that in 50 years you get rid of poverty, you get rid of famine, you get rid of wars. I mean, the replicator could be a huge part of that, right? Because if you bring in, again, forgetting about how the matter, where it comes from, what you're fueling that machine with, whatever. if we have replicators and all of a sudden... You know, that whole thing about, like, currency disappearing and money not being an issue is a little complicated, the way it works, right? Is it, like, what is it? Is it a communist society? Is it more socialist? Like, what exactly is happening? Regardless, let's say the poorest town in the world now has a replicator. They never have to worry about food. Now they're healthier. Now they can focus on education. You know, like, there's all of these things start disappearing very, very quickly if you have something like the replicator show up.
I think the closest, and one of the implications of that would be the value of handmade items would probably go up because they would be more rare and valued.
And that's what I was getting at in response to your comment on that. It's like, so what does it matter if I didn't have food before? Now I don't care if it's made from a machine or if it's, you know, grown and cultivated and cooked with love and care, you know?
Some people, now I'm not hungry. So some people will care, and if they have the resources, they'll spend the money to get a really nice meal.
But you bring people who are in like extreme poverty all the way up to now I'm fed.
Yeah,
like,
but I mean, here's
necessities.
We are living here we're recording this here in Manhattan where you can get, you know, a $2 hot dog, or you can spend like over $1,000 on a meal. So if people have resources, if they value something, they might spend the money on it. I think with the other change that would happen, the societal change that will happen with replicators, is services will go up in terms of value, and the type of careers people go into might be more service oriented. So it might be less about manufacturing goods, but providing a service to other humans. So I'm in a service-based industry as a psychologist. I provide a service to help people be their best selves. I think those type of jobs and those type of careers would be more valued. The closest I think we're going to get to that aspect of Star Trek's utopian future is through more genetic engineering of food and creating food and crops that can be grown in more environments, grown more cheaply, be more resistant, feed more people, and be healthier. The more we're able to do that, and the more we're able to get rid of some of these problems related to malnourishment, that is going to help a lot of other places and communities to rise up. One of the problems, though, is with water. So mm-hmm. with climate change happening, water we can drink is becoming more of a valuable resource. So we might be able to feed more people, but are we going to be able to have enough access to water that is going to be able to hydrate enough people? I don't think we have a good solution for that short of replicators
now. Replicator just makes water. Yeah. A water replicator. I mean, there's strides in genetically modified food constantly. There's like new materials that can grab water and condensation from the air. I mean, those are things that are obviously problems right now, and we're moving toward them. But now that I'm thinking about it, I think that anything that exists now, right, that kind of approximates what we see in Star Trek, that could help us really move forward to really making a better world. Again, the event that happens in Star Trek is that we realize that we're not alone in the universe, and we all kind of band together and work together, and things happen.
And
right?
There's World War III, so I think that's an important thing.
Well, but that's already done.
Yeah,
right?
But the first contact happens in the wake of this global...
10 years after.
10 years after. Yeah, but, yeah. Like, the world, yeah. Like, most major cities have been destroyed.
Yep.
So I think that's an important context here. Like the EU, mm-hmm. the EU was formed in the context, or in the wake of World War II. Mm-hmm. And it was a decision to, let's combine ourselves economically, make ourselves interdependent on one another so that we don't do this again.
Yeah.
So I think Earth was primed for something like First Contact.
Well, so here are my two. I think, I didn't think about that until our conversation, but I think Replicator and Universal Translator are like the... If we had those two right now, I think we could leapfrog towards a better, more positive world.
The replicator would be huge. I mean, that would change a lot. So I think the closest we're going to get, last time, on the last episode, we talked about global cooperation and uniting on these larger goals that can't be achieved individually. That's how we get over some of that conflict. Do you want to mark it at all? Can you mark?
Nope, fine.
La 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 la.
That's
we're
New
gonna
York.
Cut that out.
No, don't do that.
Oh, we're not cutting that out.
No, don't cut that out. That's okay. New York City.
That's New York City. Okay, so global cooperation will come from uniting on large goals that we can't achieve ourselves. I think climate change is going to be that for our generation. In our lifetime, I think we are going to see more global cooperation as a result of this conflict that we can't achieve, we can't overcome individually. Every country has to work together to overcome that. With disease, advances in health are going to do that. But, you know, Josue, I don't think we're ever going to be able to quite eliminate disease from this planet. Right now, Zika is breaking out. A few years ago, it was SARS. There's always some type of new thing that's going to break out. And the other thing that's happening right now is as the polar ice caps are melting, there's potentially new viruses that have been stored there for thousands and thousands of years that are now going to be released that we might have absolutely no
immunity to.
So I think I don't think we're going to be able to break out and overcome disease. I think it's always going to be there. I think we're going to get better at responding to it. So I think that's kind of a wash. But this overcoming poverty thing, I think we can do that. And I don't think we necessarily need a replicator, or at least not overcoming poverty, but empowering people in decreasing malnourishment. I think we can get around malnourishment, and there's a lot of social-based interventions we can do to uplift communities. Right? One of the biggest things you can do is empowering women in a culture in which women have less opportunities is linked to a number of amazing outcomes for society. So I think we can get pretty close on a number of these things, and some of those things are low-tech solutions.
So pick one technology from
Star Trek?
Yeah. Or, you know, a parallel to now that would make that you think would make the biggest impact?
Oh, the man. Soonest?
Because, like, I hear you saying about, like, can we empower women, educate women in different countries? So there I'm thinking, well, there's so many, if we can increase access to information, and that could possibly be a part of the universal translator thing, right?
Yep.
Where there are enough free educational resources out there, you know, putting the access aside, right? That we can now, doesn't matter what language you know, there are countries in the world that speak, you know, 100 different languages. So if people can access all of those, you know, universally access educational resources, that could help, right? And it could be something as simple as, how do I treat an infection, right? Or how do I treat a cut? Or how do I cook this properly so that my kids, you know, aren't poisoned by it? Or
can
how
I
do
pick
I
two?
Fix this?
Can I pick two?
I picked two. I said universal translator and replicator, yes.
Well, you know, it's funny because you and I both got slated to be in communications
yep.
from the Starfleet Academy experience, and I want to go with some combination of the universal translator and the holodeck.
Okay.
It's not the warp drive. It's not transportation because, again, it freaks me out, and I think you're destroying people and recreating
yeah,
them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
that's really freaky. And it's not the replicator because I think that's really far-fetched. I think being able to... I think that's just so far away from being possible. But I do think if you are able to create a universal translator, which I think is easier on Earth than it is in Star Trek because we have less languages that we're dealing with, if you combine that with some type of holographic or VR, kind of like what you and I talked about on the last episode, way of interacting with each other through something like the internet where you're not just talking or tweeting or texting at each other, but it's like a face-to-face interaction that engages empathy. If you have those things and you're able to talk to anyone in the world in a way that's very human to human, that can help us move closer to some of those global cooperation goals and help us to overcome things like climate change, these big challenges that we have facing our planet, and promote more of that Star Trekian utopian, optimistic future. And I think I think Josue, those things are possible. We might see that in our lifetime.
I read an article, I think it was on Wired, that said, it talked about the effect that the image of the Earth, the
yeah.
first photo of Earth, right,
yeah.
from space, had on the world.
Yeah.
You know, that some people even attribute many movements to that picture,
yeah.
right, that the many environmental movements to that picture. Because all of a sudden you could empathize with how small the world is, right? And how it's all connected and it's all one thing. And I agree, the power of having those empathic experiences, the more realistic we can make them, right? Being able to see something through someone else's eyes or to just have an experience of going to a different place and seeing what another person goes through is huge, right?
Maybe.
And right now we do that in VR. Holodeck would be the extreme, you know, best.
Maybe we should say have everyone on this planet be able to take a trip into the orbit of Earth. Most astronauts talk about what a meaningful experience it is to see the Earth in its whole or to see part yeah. of it from above and how fragile it looks and how peaceful and calm it looks and how from space... you don't even see humans. We're such a small speck on this planet
yeah.
that it is a complete change in how they see things. And in Star Trek Insurrection, this person, this alien on this planet, from the Baku villager, asked Commander or Captain Picard, "Have you ever lived inside a moment that seemed to last forever?" And he says, "When I saw my planet for the first time from space." So maybe. Maybe that should be what we should say, is everyone gets a trip.
Yeah, there's a whole group right now that's dedicated to replicating that experience as faithfully as possible. The experience of being in outer space, being kind of in a zero-G environment, looking out that window and looking at that, because they believe so strongly that that alone will propel us forward.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that in the show notes because I completely forgot about mentioning that earlier.
Well, and, you know, some of these solutions are, what they speak to, again, is what the technology allows us to do. And here we're talking about the technology giving us a completely new view on our planet here. So it's not about, it's really not about star tracking beyond anywhere, but it's really about star tracking within, I guess. And that's all I got to say about that, Josue.
Okay, I'm trying to find that article. Oh, I can't find it. I can't find it.
So I'd really love to hear from all of you about what you think about star tracking technology. And you can hit us up on Twitter. I am at Alima2. Josue, what are you on Twitter?
I am Josue A. Cardona.
And in the meantime, you can also find me on The Psych Show on YouTube. And I also run a website called BrainKnowsBetter.com where I talk about the psychology of science fiction. And again, you can meet both of us in person. We'd love to see you and talk to you a little bit more about this at Star Trek Mission New York on September 2nd at our panel, which is going to be at 5:30.
Yes.
This way, I bought you as much time as you can. Did you find it?
I did find it. It's called, okay, so the article is from Wired. It's called So You Think You Love Earth? Wait Until You See It in VR by Sarah Scholes, published on June 21st, 2016. And I'll put a link to it because it is, I mean, it kind of encapsulates everything that we talked about. And yeah. I completely forgot about the article until now. Yeah, and Kelly will be back in a few episodes. And yeah. Until then, we'll have multiple guest stars. I don't know who exactly they will be, but there will be people in the mental health psychology space who also have interest in either science fiction or technology or just cool stuff. We'll figure it out. We'll be all right.
And Josue, you're probably going to record our panel for Geek Therapy.
Right. Yep. So that'll be like another crossover with Geek Therapy. Yeah, because it touches on fandom, you know, yeah. And kind of we'll look at the good and the bad, but I think overall,
overall, it's pretty darn good.
We're going to be celebrating Star Trek fandom and talking about that. Yep. So thank you for listening. And again, psychtechpodcast.com.
If you go to Instagram, oh no, it's going to be gone.
It's a story because you did it all as a story. That's the thing with stories.
Go check out the story. I got it all posted.
Nope.
But I guess not.
Nope.
Yep. So don't do that. Well, you can still follow me on Instagram at Alima2, but you won't find the story there.
No. And psychtechpodcast.com. Remember, we're doing video game stuff on headshotspodcast.com and the Star Trek convention. What's it called? It's Star Trek
Mission New York.
Mission New York. Right. Star Trek Mission New York panel will be on geektherapy.com. Yep. All right. Thank you, Dr. Alima2, for coming on.
Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome anytime. So think about it.
Sounds good.
Think about it. All right.